welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Last week, Prairie Public welcomed one of the country's best-known journalists to Bismarck. NPR Morning Edition and Up First co-host Steve Inskeep visited North Dakota as part of NPR's America in Pursuit initiative, exploring the nation's history as it approaches its 250th birthday. During his visit, Inskeep sat down with Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library's executive director, Robbie Loft, for a wide-ranging conversation about Theodore Roosevelt's remarkable connection to North Dakota, the vision behind the new Presidential Library opening July 4th in Medora, conservation, leadership, civic engagement, and why Roosevelt's story still matters today. Along the way, Inskeep also reflected on journalism, curiosity, and the importance of helping people understand the world around them. We're pleased to bring you that conversation.
And good evening. It is wonderful to be here, and please don't take offense that I went to 49 other states before yours. It's already been an incredible visit. I'm traveling with Lily Quiroz, an NPR producer, because we're doing a story. We're going to do some interviews tomorrow at the Theodore Roosevelt Library. And it's already been an amazing visit. We landed at the airport this morning and went directly over to look at Fort Abraham Lincoln, which is a great site to look at. And it's beautiful landscape just going across there. I mean, I know it's totally normal to you guys, but it was wondrous and new to me. And I loved seeing it. And it's one of those moments when you realize, like, I'm going and seeing amazing things all over the world, and it's my job. It's my work. It's the thing that I get to do, and that I have done for a little while, and the hours can be a little bit difficult, but you can go around the world, you can pick up a phone, you can call almost anybody in the world, and they may talk to you. After a while, they may also hang up on you, but you do get a chance very often to talk. I'm originally from Indiana, from Carmel, a suburb of Indianapolis, and this is a joke I tell often, but it is also absolutely true. When it came time for me to go to college from Indiana, I wanted to get as far away from Indiana as I could imagine, which is why I went to Kentucky. For those of you who are geographically challenged, that is the very next state. But it turned out to be very different than the world that I had known in a very nice suburb of Indianapolis. It was coal mining country in eastern Kentucky, and it was beautiful, and it was a different kind of people and a different history. And I was fascinated and loved the place. And that began my process, really, of discovering the world for myself. I'd read about the world in books. I'd hardly seen anything. And I have expanded out from there until I have now arrived at all 50 states and several dozen countries around the world. And wherever I go, I meet different kinds of people, and I get an opportunity to hear their stories, to learn their stories, and bring them back and deliver them to you, which is a tremendous privilege. And I never get tired of it, even though I do get tired. People commonly ask, so I'll just tell you, and you don't have to ask if you were curious. People say, what time do you get up in the morning? I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning when I'm doing the show, which I no longer do every single day because it's a bit of a rotation. I get up at 3 o'clock Eastern time. I need to show up at work at 4 o'clock Eastern time. And the program has to start absolutely at 5 a.m. Eastern time to the second. It cannot be 1 second late. And that is the job, that is the challenge, but it is worth it because it's an opportunity, a daily opportunity to learn and a daily opportunity to talk to you. I started as a sportscaster. That really is true. At my high school radio station, I had an opportunity to call football and girls basketball games for 91.3 FM. I guess it's probably also true in North Dakota, but in Indiana, like, sports are a big deal. Football's a big deal. Basketball is a ridiculously big deal. You have learning experiences. For example, there was the time during a girls' basketball game that I was calling the play-by-play, and it's on this high school radio station, but people are really listening. It's heard all over town. People are really listening to this radio station, and it appeared to me that the power had gone out on this little box from which I was broadcasting in the stands of this ball game, and that is why I said several words of profanity. And it was only later that I learned that, in fact, the power had not gone out. So you learn. But more to the point, aside from don't do profanity on FCC-regulated stations, you learn something else that turns out to be relevant to covering the news. In a way, I was doing the very same thing when I was sportscasting that I try to do for you now. Because I would go to this ball game, and it's my high school. So obviously, I have a preference as to who wins the game. But it's not my job to root for anybody. It's my job to tell you what is going on the court, to tell you what the score is, and to analyze a little bit why one side may be winning or losing, and give you an adequate description that you have a picture of the game in your mind, and you can make up your own mind about that game. And what I learned to do then is what I try to do now. It has obviously been a difficult time for the media and a difficult time for public media, but in a way, not really. Because you guys, many people in this room, I'm sure, have stepped up and made sure that we continue broadcasting, that we continue getting up to do our jobs in the middle of the night. So thank you very much for your support. It's meant a lot. I do not expect you to agree with every point of view you hear on NPR. In fact, I would fail to do my job if you agreed with everything that was on the radio. You don't need me to just give you things that you already agree with. I should give you a wide range of views that you agree and disagree with. I do not expect you to agree with every fact that we report, but we will do our best to make sure that fact is a fact, and that we have verified it, and that we can name our sources so that you have an opportunity yourself to figure out what is right and what is wrong there, and to challenge us if necessary. And if there is a specific story we do that you think is off, you should write me. Reach out to your local station. You should do what you need to do to raise a specific concern about a specific story, because you really are part of the process. I'm a journalist. That's a really cool job title, and it's really exciting to get to be on the radio in front of all of you, but really what I am is a citizen, same as you. And some of you may not be citizens of the United States. If not, you're a citizen of another country. Everybody in this room is a citizen, and I mean in that sense of participation in society. We're all in this together, and our job is to help each other along and help inform each other, and that is the center of my work. Now, before I bring up Robbie Loff, I want to mention something about Theodore Roosevelt and journalism. This is one of my top 1,000 favorite stories about Theodore Roosevelt. I love Theodore Roosevelt, but definitely in the top 1,000. And this is noted in Doris Kearns Goodwin's book about Roosevelt and a relationship with a bunch of journalists. And there is an occasion in which he called, and apparently he did this more than once, but there's a specific occasion related in which he calls a journalist into the White House. And the journalist is interested in what's going on in a particular government agency, is concerned about corruption. Now, the modern way for a president to deal with that would be to say, liar! I'm not saying any particular president. I'm just saying that's the modern way to deal with bad news. It probably was even the way then to deal with bad news, but it wasn't Theodore Roosevelt's approach. He said to the reporter, go into that agency, talk to everyone, you have my permission, and let me know what you find out. Because he wanted to know. And if there was corruption in that agency, he wanted to know so that he could address it. Now, Roosevelt did not always get along with the press. I believe he sued a publisher for libel and won. So he would challenge people, and he had really strong opinions about what was written about him, but he was open to learning information, and he was aware of the value of an independent voice. Another citizen who did not answer to him going in to look around and reporting what they found. And in that spirit, I want to invite Robbie Loff up here to talk a little bit more about Theodore Roosevelt. Get him up here.
Oh, wow. I brought my parents.
You've got approximately half the crowd as your family, is that
well,
right?
Well, it's key to bring your mom.
Oh, important.
Where's your mom? Where's your
She's
mom?
Right over here.
She needs to stand up.
If I didn't introduce her, she would. Yeah, there's my mom. Thank you, Steve.
Anyway, congratulations. Congratulations on the library. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. I hear it's a little different than the average library building.
We're doing something a little different in the Badlands. So first, it's an honor to be with you here today. I didn't know that. You reminded me. I looked at my mom during the intro. I remembered my first journalism story was I was a high school broadcaster as well.
Wow.
And my one listener texted me during it because I was talking about Edith Hamilton's mythology the whole basketball game.
Okay.
And it turns out that was not the coverage. So
that was not relevant to
the... My parents texted me that was not my profession during the show. But so, yeah, you could tell early I was into history, and that's kind of how this whole journey began.
Amazing.
We're building a... institution of cultural significance in the heart of the Badlands.
I've seen pictures. What does it look like, though? Can you describe it to someone?
Well, you know, we're building a 100,000 square foot building that is achieving the Living Building Challenge, which is zero water, zero waste, zero energy, zero carbon, day one. It will be one of 300 buildings on Earth to achieve that significance. And I would joke, but it's also mildly true, that it's about the size of the other 299 combined. The rest of them are small little corners of a building. And what we're doing is we're building the greenest building on Earth. In the entrance of the heart of the Badlands, at the entrance of Theodore Roosevelt National Park, the only national park in the entire system named after a person, dedicated to the life and legacy of our greatest American, in my opinion, but the fun, we got some cheering crowds over here, we got some TR fans.
Wait, you just said greatest American. Your mom is here?
Yes, and my wife.
Okay.
And my wife, but they're top three.
Yeah. Your wife's name is?
Medora, it's a little on the nose.
Okay.
Yeah, we met on a blind date in Medora. We're set up by some of your sponsors here tonight. I mean, I filled the room. I made this successful before.
Wow.
Before it even happened.
Okay, but well done. What were we talking about? Oh, yes.
Hard to say.
Building. I mean, but it looks like it's built into the ground.
Yeah, so it's
like a sod house.
It's subservient to the landscape.
Okay.
Which we had a design competition early on in this project. I've been involved in this project for 11 years, which is, my mother-in-law would say, I'm a puppy, you know, but my entire professional career has been dedicated to Theodore Roosevelt's life and legacy in North Dakota, which is something I did not predict. But we held a design competition. We invited 100 of the world's most incredible architect firms to submit ideas on what they would do in the Badlands to tell the story of TR, which sounds really romantic and beautiful, but really is a really great way to get free work when you have no funding, no land, no architect. So we had them submit these designs, and then we've narrowed it down to the final three.
They're like submitting them on spec, right?
Yep, yeah, we sent them a portfolio, some ideas, some inspiration. We said, give us your best ideas.
Okay.
Narrowed it to the final three, and those design competitions could be very substantially difficult for a board. Five people might like this, six like the other, it breaks up the whole thing. Quickly, all 11 of our board members united around this design because it is about the place, it is not about the building. And in doing that, you're building one of the top 100 buildings you need to see before you die. It's architecturally significant.
I just have to ask, of the other submissions, did anybody propose like a skyscraper?
One of our finalists was a little substantial in height. It was meant to be, you know, meant to be kind of a teepee formation, looking like a smoke. But we didn't want to see it from different points of the Badlands. So now the cool thing about when you're in the park itself, you can see the library, but you can't see the library. You have to know what you're looking for.
State the obvious. Why would it be meaningful for a library to this president to be as environmentally efficient as you described?
TR in, the word conservation was known by hundreds of people before TR. I mean, him and John Muir were having conversations privately. They weren't, you know, the Speaker of the House when TR became president said, I will not give tens a dime to scenery. Conservation was considered scenery. It wasn't about conserving the population of animal species that have gone on to make the West the West. It wasn't about saving the locations from private development that perhaps would inflict harm for generations to come. It was about scenery. So TR himself, in his first address to Congress, you know, 2.5 hour long speech to Congress that wasn't wildly well received, began discussing conservation largely for the first time. He pushed ideas as governor, but this was not a topic of the national dialogue. So he looked 100 years out into the problems of the future. So our building, what we're trying to do is obviously look 250 years out into the future and say, what will the future cultural institution be like? What will the future community be like? How can we be example for how to take care of our planet and also build and preserve and use the land around us? So for us, it was an obvious thing to do.
I want to talk about some aspects of TR's story. And first is the idea that I think a lot of people have their own Theodore Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Just as, I mean, when I studied Lincoln, you find out everybody has their own Lincoln, right?
Yeah.
Like their own story, in their own backdrop and their own favorite tale of a quote that he never said or really said or whatever.
Yeah, the best ones he didn't say.
There was one in the public library. I can't remember the quote exactly. In the public library here, we were there today in the coffee shop. Coffee shop is wonderful. There's a quote from Lincoln on the wall. Pretty sure he never said that. But
he would have loved it.
I'm sure he would have approved of it. Oh, what was it? It's not the number of years in the life. It's the amount of life in the year.
Life.
Yeah. And I just don't know that he said that. Yeah. It doesn't have that ring of authenticity. But I'm sure he would approve of this. So it's nothing against it, which was awesome. And I love that you have a library with a coffee shop in the library. It is awesome. It's awesome. It's such a great library. Anyway, okay. So this is what I want to ask you. Like, tell me your earliest memories of being excited about this president. I can remember being excited about this president when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So tell me.
Well, you're in North Dakota, you're born, and instantly people tell you that if it had not been for his time in North Dakota, T.R. would not have been president, that he said that. And as some great historians in this area also will tell you, it's very rarely mentioned in North Dakota that he immediately said that in Montana. Well, so there was a politician in this man, but we have a deep connection to this guy who had 20 trips in his life to North Dakota, only about 2 years of his life. Hmm. But it was the fulcrum point of the hero's journey. He came here in 1883, September 8th, hopped off the train to hunt a buffalo. He knew just like
Let's back up. 1883.
Yeah.
So he's 24. Early 20s.
Yeah.
Okay.
Newly married, a political success story, an aristocrat of New York, wealthy beyond all belief. Everything's going right. This guy can do no wrong. He comes here to hunt a buffalo before he knows they're extinct. Knows as much as he knows anything else, that they'll be gone soon. Wasn't thrilled about that, but not yet motivated as his life purpose.
Uh-huh.
He spends 2 weeks finding the buffalo, which we would call a bison, and then discovers it, harvests that buffalo, brings it back, and notifies his wife, his newlywed Alice, that he has great news. They have no more financial issues in the future. We're ranchers now. I bought a ranch while I was away. The news that a spouse would always dream of hearing. So he bought it. It was a financial disaster. TR and money, not so good.
Can I just stop to ask, is there anyone here whose spouse has come home and announced that they bought a ranch? Is there anyone at any time? Okay, rare thing. Go on, please. Okay.
Challenge us to do more.
That's good.
That's good. So, but then he returns a whole year later, 1884. It's a whole different vantage point in his life. After he gets he's in the New York State Assembly. He's just had birth of his new daughter, Alice. He gets a telegram from his brother that says, there's a pox on this house. Mother's dying and Alice is dying. Alice is dying too. Goes ashen white, drops it, rushes out on the train. It's as foggy as it could be. The train ride took four times as long as the usual train ride to get home. He knows he's going to say goodbye to the two most important people in his life. And when he gets there, he spends moments with both of them before they pass on the same day in the same house, Valentine's Day. And he takes out his diary, and he puts an X and says, the light has gone out of my life.
Hmm.
So a broken man gives up on his life, abandons his newborn daughter, and heads west, begins to engage in incredibly risky behavior, challenges the Marquis de Mor to a duel, accepts it, which T.R. was called Old Four Eyes for a reason in the West. It was the first pair of glasses anybody had seen in the Badlands.
What was the duel about?
It was a horrible, two guys who were pretty big in town.
Testosterone.
There was a little testosterone involved. But T.R. de-escalates, and he starts connecting the land. He buys another ranch, because the first one was such a wild success, this time the Elkhorn. And the Maltese Cross, his first ranch was way too close to town, only 6 miles from Medora, 8 miles. So he buys one that's 35 miles. You have to cross the river 23 times to get to the Elkhorn. He was running away from his life, from his problems, from his prosperity. He'd given up. But instead of giving up, he healed himself in this place. And you're going to experience it tomorrow. On the Badlands, there's thousands of places on Earth that have mountains. There's thousands of places on Earth that have beaches. There's one little scrap of Earth that has the Badlands. And I think there's something divine about the fact that a year before he lost everything, he found a place that would help him have his life wish, mm-hmm. his desire to keep going, to heal from the outdoors. So when we want people to come to this library, I want them to feel what I learned about TR when I was a kid, which is that, yeah, he looked like the most successful guy forever the whole time. But there was a point in his life that could have gone a different direction. So the fulcrum point in our hero's journey, TR, was in the Badlands of North Dakota. So kids can learn and connect to that.
Wasn't that, though, also itself a terrible experience? There was a horrible winter, right?
Oh, it was absolutely, there's a lot of horrible winters in the 1880s in the Badlands of Dakota.
But
he lost his entire
time today, right?
There's no it's sunny and 70 in
Good.
February, no question at all.
Yeah. Climate change.
there's some things that go the other way, yeah. But I would say this sincerely about the Badlands and his time. It was a blip in the radar of history that this town was relevant to the time of 1880. There's one week in 1883 where three presidents randomly showed up. Grant, Arthur, and T.R. all in one week's time. And then 10 years later, it's a ghost town once again.
Wow.
So again, there's this connection to this place that it just feels to have had a significance that wasn't appreciated then, and frankly, isn't appreciated now. We're 4 hours from South Dakota, the Black Hills. We're 5 hours to 6 hours from Yellowstone Gate. We get almost 1 million people in the Badlands, but they get 5 million. Mm. So it's our belief that we need to join this TR triangle. We have an important part of this story, and that people will have a better experience if they see the place that healed TR, and perhaps it'll heal them.
But tell me a little more of the story. Remind me a little more of the story. So 1884, he buys this ranch. He buys a bunch of cattle,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's actually going to be a rancher.
Oh, yeah. He was elected to local office 2 years after his first time in the Badlands. Hmm. I am 10 years into my Badlands journey. A local I am not.
Elected to local office here.
I married Medora. It didn't work, you know?
Okay.
So what I would say is they very quickly appreciated this man who showed up in a custom-made Brooks Brothers Western, I'll say costume, and which we have at the TR Library. Come see it.
Oh, I can't wait.
He came with a custom-made Tiffany's knife, you know, Tiffany's known for their knife making, to hunt with, that had himself cut into it, you know?
Okay.
His daughter famously said of him he wanted to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. He and I share this in common, but... it's very sincere. He came and he had glasses, the first pair of glasses anybody had ever seen in the Badlands. They called him Old Four Eyes.
Wow.
And 2 years later, he was the most respected person in the community. In 1886, the city of Dickinson invited him to give the 4th of July remarks. He gave an incredible speech, probably my favorite speech of his entire political career. He said, I like big things, doing bold things. America is about doing the most. And then he finished it, I am as much an Easterner as a Westerner. How many people can say that and the community embraces you?
What did he have that caused people to... love him like that?
I genuinely think that that's kind of the real essence of TR. It's his charisma. It's his magnetism. It's his energy. The guy was up early, read a book a day. He was somebody who threw himself at every problem. He was engaging. You know, he had relationships across the spectrum of society. He was somebody from an incredibly wealthy background. His grandfather was one of the top five most wealthy people in New York. But was a sickly boy who wasn't supposed to live past 18. He experienced adversity, and then through that adversity, built a perspective of connection to people that didn't have the life he did. That's not something we think of with our politicians.
He is definitely someone who wanted to physically challenge himself, right?
He had to build his own body. He was deeply sick, deeply asthmatic. The prescription for asthma at the time wasn't quite the best. It was for father to get a cigar and inhale it and puff the exhale into the...
You're gonna smoke it out?
You gotta smoke it out, man. We've all been there,
okay.
College. Yeah. But sorry, kids. Don't do that. But that was the prescription for the ailments of his body. He was in New York. There was no public sanitation system. The city was killing him as a young boy. So his father famously said, you have the mind, but you do not have the body. Go build your body. His father didn't like, oh, I feel so bad, TR. There's nothing we can do. He said, fix it. And TR, any problem encountered, TR would say, overcome it. Beat it. Just, you know. Destroy your issues, do something better, dare greatly, think boldly, live passionately. These ethos and ideas that we're trying to do at the TR Library. This entire institution we're building, I got to see some friends who were early supporters of this project, the Badlands Conservation Alliance. Yeah, there we go. But this entire time, there are people who perhaps said, this is too big of an idea for North Dakota. You know, I am honored that you're a 50th state here too, but we want to be people's first state they visit. We have an incredible story. We have an incredible ad about Medora that I loved for years. It was spend a day in Medora. It's now, we need way more than a day in the Badlands to experience this place that changed TR and can change you. So for me, that's like the ethos.
A month in Medora is alliterative, so you could go with that.
Yeah, that would work. Yeah, we can
work that into
that.
The musical.
We'll get in it.
Which we're going to see tomorrow night, by the way.
Musical, yeah. Pretty good.
Go on. You were talking about.
Well, no.
You're talking about like his physical endurance, building up his physical endurance.
And that's what he did in the Badlands. He got outside. He crossed the river 23 times to get to the Elkhorn Ranch. Mm-hmm. I mean, he built his body. He challenged himself. He said it was where the romance of his life began. That's hard to imagine after the loss he had. To describe the next period of his life as romantic. I think it's also beautiful. TR, you know, lived an incredible life. I tend to think it almost reads like fiction. It's unbelievable if it weren't proven to be true.
It's impossible that he did so many things.
He was a top five president by all historical standards, but the most interesting part of his life were before and after his presidency. That's fascinating to me. He explored the Amazon as a post-president. Imagine one of our former presidents exploring the River of Doubt. Tough to imagine. But he did that. And he lived more life in these years beyond. But famously, at the near end of his life, a guy named Senator Albert Fall, who is known sadly now for the phrase, the Fall Guy, mm-hmm. the Interior Secretary during the Teapot-Dote scandal, side story, he asked T.R., if you could relive one period of your life, one time again over, what would it be? And this was the guy who was the president of the United States. He the Amazon adventure, the River of Doubt. He did Africa. War hero, beyond all measure, the Rough Rider. And he said it would have been my time as a rancher in Dakota Territory. So it's not us saying that North Dakota, we didn't steal it from New York. TR would have wanted it here because this is the point where it all changed. And he wouldn't have been a Rough Rider. He wouldn't have been the greatest conservationist in the history of the world, which I hope he surpassed someday. He wouldn't be one of our greatest presidents and a uniter that is loved by both the left and the right of American politics at a time of great division. He's the favorite president of Senator Hawley and Senator Warren. Perhaps there's something that we should learn from him that he can bring us all together.
Still to come on Main Street, more of NPR's Steve Inskeep's conversation with Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library Executive Director Robbie Loff, including some excellent questions that came from the audience. Stay with us. Welcome back to Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We now return to NPR's Steve Inskeep and Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library Executive Director Robbie Loff as they discuss how the new library will bring Roosevelt's ideas and the conversations they inspire to a new generation.
Why do you think that is? Why would he appeal to such a wide spectrum of people?
Well, TR is a bit of a Rorschach test. What you see in him says more about you than it says about TR. He's such a magnetic story that we all want to connect to him. You know, there's few presidents that perhaps unite us in such ways. When TR was alive in his post-presidency and already had run again for president in 1912 and considered in 16 and was a front runner in 1920 before he died, you know, America was building Mount Rushmore. There was, of course, Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson on this place, and the country was having an honest, huge debate on we got spot for one more. Some people say the spot's for other more, but there's four spots for a president on Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
And the fourth one, the country was debating who should we put, and the nation, while he was alive, selected Theodore Roosevelt to be along Washington.
He was alive?
He was alive. 1919, wow. It was when he passed away that the beginning in construction was already underway on Mount Rushmore. They'd picked
him. That was risky. Like, what if he'd, like, had some scandal, if he'd lived longer and, you know.
Well, you know, that's, things worked out.
Okay, yeah.
But fair point.
Yeah.
Imagine a politician in modern day, a civic leader, an elected leader, that the country would say, that one.
Yeah.
That one by Lincoln Washington. So he is unique in that way. So we want this to be a place that we embrace that. We take that as a feature, not a bug, that the left and right love him. And we bring him together for important talk. We have three pillar principles: conservation, citizenship, and leadership. But if we had a favorite, it's probably conservation. This is about the planet that we love. And the first two feed that conversation. So we want to use this as a convening space to be the center of conservation dialogue for decades to come.
This conversation here about conservation and other things has gone incredibly quickly. It's amazing. We're going to go for a few more minutes, and then we're going to invite your questions. But I want you to talk a little bit more specifically about what's in the museum and how you tell the story you just described. Like, what are some of the cool features in there?
Well, it's going to be, I would say with great sincerity, one of the greatest historical institutions in the world. It's a 100,000 square foot building with two separate buildings with one roof. In the first peoples that inhabited the Badlands, they used, the indigenous peoples before us, they used rammed earth walls and sod roofs to build structures. So what do we got? We got a rammed earth wall and a sod roof. It's an homage to the first peoples that TR had a complex relationship with. But it's there to tell the story of perhaps one of our greatest Americans and not lionize him, but to use him to inspire you to get in the arena. So we have what is going to be eight chapters of his life told birth to death sequentially, where you move in between adventure rooms and chambers, where you get to learn from TR, not about TR. Through the middle, there's the narrative gallery, the traditional texts on the wall, artifacts under glass, over 500 artifacts of incredible significance. That diary, for the first time in 125 years in American history, it will be in a museum for people to see, for kids to see and to connect to. His Rough Riders, apparel will be on display for you to see. The exact outfit he wore as he took Kettle Hill. You'll be able to see and learn from him. You'll get to ride down the River of Doubt with him in a 14-minute projected experience around you, sitting in three canoes, getting to see the incredible story that reads like complete and total fiction. And you'll get to be inspired by it. You'll get to talk with TR. We have a partnership with Microsoft. We've developed the first ever AI president that you can engage with. He was the writingest president in history. Technology today has gone from the greatest thing to one of the most complex and difficult things. We think there are ways to utilize it, to harness it, to challenge us to see things from a perspective of a great
American.
Tell
me a little bit more about that. So I walk up to TR and I say, how you doing? And he answers me.
Well, as TR would, he would first say, you in the blue, get up here, ask me a question. I can see you. So he genuinely, when you walk in the room, he's like, get on it. Like, let's start chatting. He will talk to you. Yesterday I had a conversation with him. I said, you know, I was getting to chat with you, learn a little bit more about, I was like, tell me about the significance of North Dakota to your story. And he again told the story of February 14th, 1884. I would love to pretend it was my framing. But TR himself engages on topics. You could talk about relationship advice. I have a beautiful marriage, but to test it, I pretended I was like dating somebody. And I said, TR, I got this girlfriend. I don't know where it's going. What do you think I should do? This type of, he said, does she like the outdoors? Does she challenge you to be better? If not, dump her. I was like, well, TR, we probably shouldn't be advising people to dump folks. But, you know, we're pushing the boundaries. This would be controversial.
That actually raises a question for me. So you've set up this thing, and it's a kind of a chatbot, but it's a TR chatbot. And I bet there's somebody in this room that's uncomfortable with that
idea. There should be.
You know, and so did you have a moment of discomfort of wondering if you even wanted to do this?
Unquestionably. We've had many moments of discomfort in this project. But on that specific topic, we want to see, first, you have to build guardrails, and we've done that. But this is where technology is going. So in our thoughts, we want to engage with a new generation of people who aren't like me. I was 23 and I'd already been to every presidential library. That's a niche. It was really cool in high school.
How many was that?
This is the first year in American history where two presidential libraries are open. Yeah. So Obama just opened on Juneteenth and now Theodore Roosevelt's, but there's 17 now.
Okay.
This is about engaging with and learning from him, not about him. So conversing with somebody who, we have these language models that can take all of his speeches, the tens of thousands of letters he has, and put it in. And of course, you can't go up there and ask about modern day politics. Who would you vote for here, ABC? We put, he's like, he died in 1919. 1919 and before is what you can discuss with him.
So I could have a discussion about World War I.
You absolutely could. You could hear his complex feelings of encouraging all of his children to join in the combatant. He wanted to enlist. He petitioned the president to go to war. Again, bold move. The president denied him, his political enemy did. And then he lost his son in battle, and then had complex feelings of perhaps, maybe he was a little too war hungry at that time. And reflected upon it and affected what he would have been if he was president. He was a front runner to be president in 1920. He was running on issues like civil rights. He would have perhaps, if he had won, he was the front runner before he passed. You perhaps put a stake in the heart of Jim Crow 45 years before it was done.
Wow.
So you can talk to him about those topics. But no question, it should make some people uncomfortable, and it's going to be an incredible journey to see how it goes.
Somebody else told me you have celebrities reading his most famous speech.
Yeah, we got to get you to read it. We have incredible people ranging from...
I accept the invitation.
There we go. Deal. We'll do it tomorrow.
No.
But from Oprah Winfrey to our former presidents to a guy named Garth Brooks... incredible people reading in the arena speech, the Citizens of the Republic, the speech that I think, along with the Gettysburg Address, is one of the two most foundational of our country's entire history. And you'll get to get in the arena with them and hear them and how it transformed their lives. LeBron James, whenever he plays a game, he writes in the arena, Man in the Arena on his shoe. Tom Brady, what's the name of his documentary? Man in the Arena. I mean, this is a speech that has motivated generations of people. It's in half the offices of America, and we want people to see that, you know, it could be a turning point in your journey, too.
Before we take questions, let's just summarize this speech. It's not the critic who counts.
It is not the critic who counts.
It's the man in the arena who, you got to help me.
It doesn't point how the strong man stumbles, how the doer of deeds could have done them better. Rolf Sletten, help me out here. You know, the credit goes to the man who's actually, or man or woman now, who's actually in the arena.
Okay, I have an idea. While we're doing questions...
Whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood. But errs greatly. Yeah. Who knows not victory nor defeat.
Wow. We've got it here, guys.
We pieced it together as a team.
Yeah. It's fantastic.
Next time I'll have it memorized.
That's okay. It's okay. You didn't expect it. So, Robbie, thank you. Congratulations on the museum. This is fantastic. It looks like John has a microphone. Are you gonna pick the people to talk to, John?
I believe TR had some influence on the Panama Canal. Could you tell us about that? It hasn't been mentioned yet.
Yes, TR, of course, is well known for his incredible connection to the Panama Canal. TR wanted to build and do great things. At the time he came to president, the French were already well developed in their plans, and tens of thousands of lives had been lost in construction of this project that was feared to be impossible. And TR, impossible, was not really a piece of his vernacular. But the Congress and the presidents before him actually were pushing an alternative plan, one to do it in Nicaragua, looking at different sites and locations. And that was a more expensive plan, but what had been done was feared to never have been done. So TR instead, there's an incredible deal he made with a member of Congress at that time where he snuck a little language into the legislation that said, yeah, well, the Congress is formally recommending Nicaragua. And he said, he snuck in some language and then gave said senator unlimited access to the White House to say, but the prerogative is to the decision of the president. And TR, in his own moment of ingenuity, said, no, we must take over for the French. We can do this. There's a solution to this. He went down himself and engaged in the construction and built this institution that, you know, this tells about the enduring relevancy of TR. I joked, an actual friend of mine runs the Panama desk at the State Department. I said, this year, or the last 2 years, did you think you were going to be as interesting as you were going to be? When was the Panama Canal going to be a part of the American story again? In the era of Chinese power and expansion, of great power in battles, you know, TR's words and influence and his incredible ideas have become more relevant again today. So it's a great story, I think, of what America can do, how we can be a global force for good, how also stories get told by the victor would be something I'd say as well. Panama has their own very complex thoughts about TR's time there. TR was undoubtedly an imperialist, but he did it in a way pushing for human rights and access to democracy. But the people of Panama were run over in that process. So
I'm fascinated by one aspect of this, which, as I recall from my reading, the United States engineered a kind of revolution to create Panama and then got their canal. And this was all kind of controversial and much criticized, and they had elaborate stories to explain why it was okay, to which Roosevelt just said, I took the canal, right? He's just like, no, I did this.
To the victor go the spoils.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of that within him. And, you know, a lot of the parties at the time on many domestic issues were kind of aligned. It was on foreign policy that a lot of differences ended up emerging. And, and TR was certainly, you know, he had thoughts for all over the world. And he, while brokering peace, he also encouraged conflict. So yeah, it's an incredible story.
More questions.
As an educator in the western part of North Dakota, I'm in Beach, right by...
Yeah!
Yeah. My question is, how is the library, because part of the library is to educate students about the president and about conservation and other topics. So what is the library doing to educate our youth and get them more involved and knowledgeable about this area?
Well, shout out to the Beach educators. I generally think this is all about getting students into a world-class cultural institution in the place that transformed and created a great American. So we want to get 25,000 fourth graders and eighth graders a year to start to the TR Presidential Library. In eighth grade, my love of history in North Dakota began on a trip to Fort Abraham Lincoln State Park to the Capitol, which you're going to be going off to the Battle of Little Bighorn.
Little Bighorn Battlefield, yeah.
Which is 150 years from tomorrow.
That's right, yeah.
This incredible story of this place that was uniquely interesting during this period of history, 1876 to 1900. This is, for me, as a Dakota boy who is sick of being the flyover state, a very important story to tell of our own significance, and that just because you're from Beach, North Dakota, or Mayville, North Dakota, you can go on to change the world. So our goal is to get every single one of our fourth and eighth graders to North Dakota, full stop, into the TR library. Kids know about TR for many reasons, but one of them is Night at the Museum. If only we had a world-class museum they could spend a night at. You know, don't you think we should make education and history more engaging and fun and connected? I invite you all to come to our library this summer so then you can go back to your school boards and to your superintendents and support them having the daring, greatly effort of getting their kids to Medora, because Medora is good for kids. And this world needs more kids who have experienced the Badlands of the West. So thank you for what you're doing. And please bring your class to our institution. We'll help make it happen.
How does the library deal with Roosevelt's thinking about the treatment of the Native Americans, as well as some of the other contradictions regarding his feelings about races?
Absolutely. Head on is the correct way to describe it. We are not lionizing this person. TR was undoubtedly on the issues of race and ethics in his later life, deeply progressive on those issues. When he was in the Badlands himself, he had some horrible, horrible comments that he made about the indigenous peoples which he encountered. He talked a lot about civilizing races and people. His comments about I don't even want to repeat some of his comments made specifically about Native Americans. But as his life went on, he evolved and learned and grew and became one of the most deeply, critical people of his own actions and thoughts in the past. What an incredible thing and lesson to teach. You know, this is the president that dined with Booker T. Washington in the White House. When he did it, though, which, by the way, an incredible movement for the first African-American ever to dine with the president in the White House itself. But when he did it, he was also talking about how Booker T. Washington was the best of his race, how he had civilized himself. He was the one out of 10 that could dine with the president himself. But later, as he again continued to educate and learn and diversify himself, which he never did go on to invite another African-American to dine with him, he would meet with Booker T. Washington in the morning, you know, when it was civilized to meet with somebody of that stature of society, because he never would go on again to win a state in the South through an election. And you have to know that he had a deep connection to the South. He felt connected to many places, but through his mother, Minnie, who supported the South during the Civil War. So this was a man who was, of course, complex. Was he ahead of his time? It's also important to tell our kids and our youth and ourselves that if we were in that time, don't just instantly believe you would have been this incredibly thoughtful individual who would have had 21st century thoughts. No, it was deeply challenging to get to where he was in 1920, potentially running for president on civil rights issues. One of his last speeches he made was on the topic of civil rights, 45 years before he actually, before Jim Crow was shot down. Mm-hmm. So we will attack that head on, and we think it's one of the most important stories about T.R.'s life.
Yeah, one of his most famous nicknames was the Trust Buster.
Yeah.
And that seems like a very pertinent issue, current pertinent issue. I don't know if you have anything as part of this display or his words having to do with that particular aspect of his presidency.
Oh, a square deal. You know, one of the greatest political promises to a nation of a presidential campaign in history. I think one of my favorite TR quotes is in response to J.P. Morgan. He said, to the effect of something that, we're worried about this man because we don't know what he will do. And TR responds, you're worried about me because you know exactly what I'll do. Yeah, there's a little truth in there. J.P. Morgan was the Federal Reserve of that time, had the ability to bail out the entire economy. You know, TR was a deep believer in capitalism, unquestionable believer in the importance of the Western civilization. But he believed that in order for capitalism to exist, competition must exist, that trusts were a monopoly. And monopolies back then weren't just universally assumed to be a bad thing. There were intellectual minds, the greatest professors at Harvard and Yale and these different institutions. There were people who fought for the right that it cut out the unnecessary loss of competition. TR believed in opposed that with his every sense of his being. And being an aristocratic, wealthy person from New York City, from one of the richest families of New York, he didn't have to be that way. He had a very simple life. He had everything he needed. But instead, he pushed back. And in a lot of new industries that did not exist 20 years before, well, that seems pretty relevant today. A lot of our largest monopolies, potentially, are industries that didn't exist. That's where monopolies do exist. So he took on tobacco, he took on railroads, he took on finance, he took on oil and gas. And he all did it largely through the power of personality. Through his own political influence. His 1912 presidential campaign showed, he established the United States primary system because he defeated his hand-picked successor, also not big on letting other people shine. But his hand-picked successor was not achieving his goals he picked for that president. So he challenged him, and he defeated him in the electoral process, and the party said no. So he created his own political party. That's another one of those, I think, one of his most enduring and relevant issues today.
Thank you both so much. We don't have kids yet, but I think a lot about like how I will teach our kids about the balance between like independence and brute force and just like make your own political party with like consensus building and collaboration. So does TR have a shadow side that is at all collaborative?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, the answer might be no, but I think there's a lot of people who would, I most certainly think he did. He changed a lot of hearts and minds, and I think there is collaboration in that. He engaged in dialogue. He would go into rooms where he wasn't guaranteed to be popular. He would discuss his own beliefs, which I believe is collaborative. It's not, he wasn't sly in hiding from his own beliefs. He had many friends of different political persuasions, but at the same time, he had his moral compass, and that moral compass was not optional. And that's how I would teach it to my two-year-old, is that you can absolutely work with people across the political spectrum. There are people who you may find their views to be repugnant, but it is your duty as a citizen to engage with them for the greater good. but you must have a compass that you define early in your career, because power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. So, you know, I think TR most certainly was, you know, in some ways collaborative, but he never collaborated on his ethics, would be what I'd say. You know, he had a belief deep in his sense of himself of who he was and what he stood for. And that's what kids should know.
Hi, so I teach freshman civics in South Dakota. And I was wondering if you guys had any programming that you were planning for teaching like modern civics. I know you're talking a lot about Theodore Roosevelt and like the AI thing, talking about things before he died. But I was wondering if you guys were planning on kind of grafting lessons from him into the way we can engage in our modern society civically.
Oh, good question. Great question. Thanks for coming from one of the top two Dakotas. It's great to have you here. So it's absolutely is the answer. First, if you a few examples. We have a podcast. It's the host is Theodore Roosevelt V. I share it with people and they're like, I thought it'd be all about TR. No, there's thousands of places where you can get a receptacle. You can hear people like me talk about TR and every fact. But we're using this to engage in issues on topics. Citizenship being one of them. So a lot of the curriculum we're developing and sharing with K-12 classrooms, with freshman classrooms, middle school classrooms, is it utilizes TR as an inspiration, but then prompts you to discuss issues perhaps that are complex today in a different vein that will help you develop your own thoughts and perspectives on the problems of tomorrow. So he is a tool. He is not the solution, is kind of where we go. So, but I also think we need inspirational American figures. And that does not mean they are perfect in any way, shape, or form. But in this time where perhaps there's a significant amount of pessimism from both sides of the aisle, it is important to know that on our 250th birthday that America can be a global force for good, or many of us would say is a global force for good. What year do you think that the national park in Medora was most visited in its history? In Roosevelt National Park. Maybe like during pandemic or some other times. No, it was 1976, America's 200th birthday. It reached over 1 million people. We have not reached that one time since. On periods of great American significance, people gather in science museums, second floors, to talk about America. And we want this country to do that utilizing TR because, as we said, he's a Rorschach test for the left and the right. Oh my gosh, we're gonna fool you all into agreeing on something. But you'll find out that actually the complexities of issues require some actual thoughtful discussion. So we opened 2026 on the 250th birthday of America. We have a revolution of people talking about the greatness of this country and the things we can do together. Let's take a pause on talking about political figures. Let's talk about our country. And that's what we'd like to do with our civics education.
Steve, journalism has changed a lot over the last 10, 20 years. What's the importance and the future of journalism in America?
Wow. Well, I would like to think the thing that we try to do that is still in short supply is actually go out and see things for ourselves and listen to people rather than just tell you what we think. There is now an infinite supply of places you can turn for a take on something, and it might be a really funny take, it might be a really great take, it might be an accurate take. Everyone has a take, but somebody has to give some information for all those takes to be taken from. I think that it's still really important to get out there and learn people's stories and pass them on in context. In the very way that you're talking about Theodore Roosevelt, he can be a caricature, but there's actually a complex person there. And there are complex issues, and there's a complex context for a lot of the things that he did. And I want to understand things in context. And in order to do that, I need to go out and see it for myself from time to time. And if I can't see it for myself, I need to talk to a range of people who've seen a lot of different things and gathered information. I want to look at documents for myself and see what they say. I want to have that document that I just saw in context of other things. And that is a thing that we struggle to give, that I think there still is not enough of in this country, even though there is an infinity of sources that can tell you something related to the news.
Great, that was very fun.
So fast.
You've been listening to NPR's Steve Inskeep in conversation with Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library Executive Director Robbie Loft, recorded last week at a special Prairie Public event in Bismarck.
What is the effect of the Supreme Court's final decisions of its term, including one on birthright citizenship, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News?
And that's a wrap for this Tuesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll head to Memory Fireworks just south of Fargo to find out what's new in fireworks this year. We'll talk about the hottest trends, important safety tips on what you should and shouldn't do, and discover where those spectacular shells and colorful displays actually come from. Before you celebrate, join us for a behind-the-scenes look at the business of fireworks. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.